Hello and welcome to the Dancecast, where I explore dance as an art form, traveling to non-traditional places and with non-traditional doers. I'm your host and my name is Silva Lakkonen. Welcome to Dancecast episode 12. This is the third episode of my series of talking with people who do a site-specific dance, and in this episode I talked to Stephen Koplovich, who is one of my role models and idols who I look up to for inspiration and advice on work on site-specific choreography. He is an award-winning director, choreographer, media artist known for his work on stage, film and site. His site work aims to alter people's perspectives of place, site, and scale, all infused with a sense of the human condition, and is concerned with the intersection of natural, social, and cultural ecologies within urban and natural environments. Since 1984, he has created 87 works and has been awarded 60 commissions. He is the recipient of a 2004 Albert Award in the Arts, a 2003 Guggenheim Fellowship in Choreography, in addition to a 2000 New York Dance and Performance Award, BESIE, for Sustained Achievement in Choreography. Koplovich is also the recipient of 6 National Endowment for the Arts Choreography Fellowships from 1988 to 1997. In 1996, his site-specific work, Genesis Canyon, commissioned by the Dance Umbrella Festival for the Natural History Museum in London, won Time Out Magazine's award for Best Dance Production of 1996. He is the recipient of 2 distinguished alumni awards from Wesleyan University, where he received his BA in Music Composition, and from the University of Utah College of Fine Arts, where he received his MFA in Choreography. I enjoyed my conversation with him, and I hope you do too.
How did you start doing such specific work?
That's a good question in the sense that I guess you could go pretty far back to college, in that I started to choreograph in college and. While I was a music major. And so because I always wrote music, I started writing music in high school, but I wrote it, my career as a composer started with me writing music for dance, as opposed to just writing music in general. I was invited by my high school dance teacher outside of Washington, D.C. to write for a spring concert. And that teacher happened to be Liz Lerman.
Yay!
And she was on her way to becoming very famous, but it was a long time ago. And then when I got to college, I started to dance and realized I wanted to choreograph on top of also writing music. And so my senior thesis at Wesleyan was music and the visual media arts. And as part of that, I did 3 projects. I wrote film scores. I made music on videotape that was all visual. And then I created an entirely interactive video, sound, and dance event in this in a gymnasium that was going to be torn down to build a new one. And I was the first time I choreographed anything outside of the theater. And so it showed me the possibilities of at least bringing something and creating something unique outside of a theater. It wasn't site specific. That piece wasn't site specific, but it got me thinking. Uh-huh. And then right after I graduated, right after that year, I was invited to be a fellowship student at Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival. And I met Elise Bernhardt. We were just, both of us were 1 year out of college. And we got involved in what was known then as the Jacob Pillow Touring Ensemble, which toured with took dancers from the festival, student dancers, and we toured all places all over the Berkshires, in shopping centers and senior centers. Oh, wow. We went to a couple of museums, and Elise had the job of organizing the company, and she used me a lot to choreograph things for the ensemble, and that influenced both of us in terms of seeing the power of bringing dance outside of the theater. And we weren't necessarily doing site-specific work at all, but we were really experiencing the excitement of people encountering dance in that fashion. And then Elise went on.
I guess there wasn't even that name, site-specific work, back then.
Well, I think there was. I mean, there was definitely in the art world. And I think that, Meredith Monk had been doing her work by then, and Tricia Brown had been doing her work earlier, in the late 70s in galleries and buildings. So I think...
And I remember actually reading Meredith Monk saying that once things get named, she's not interested about it, or it loses something. You know, like, she was doing site-specific, but she didn't like it once it got named, once it got categorized.
You know, I have not, she's never said that to me before. And I've been very lucky to sort of, to get to know her. I interviewed her in the second iteration of my online class. So she didn't say that, but I can understand that. I can understand her saying that. I will tell you though, that my take on it is like, I'm having done site-specific work now for such a long time, mm-hmm. Like 30 years plus, that I am both surprised and gratified that more and more people are doing it. I mean, it's true. Back then, when I first started doing it, I did look towards Meredith and Tricia as inspirations. Simply because the fact that they were doing things out of the box, literally. And so, and Meredith especially, because she was a composer and a choreographer, and she was a real, she was someone I looked to, was that, oh, see, I like music and I like dance, and here's someone who's putting the two together. And I loved her work mm-hmm. on top. And so, in a way, I'm kind of gratified that something, that didn't have a community, so to speak, now has a huge community, actually. And when I did my online course, it was incredibly gratifying to know that there were so many thousands of people from 150 countries interested in site-based work, not just dance people, but artists, visual artists and film artists and musicians and actors, directors. I mean, it really made me feel like, yeah, this is something that's become or always has been inherent in the way people think about art. But, the visual arts really took somewhat of a lead on this in the sense of sighted art and site art that was created in specific sites. And and so I think that, that's really where things started in a certain sense.
Yeah. Sorry. And I sidetracked you from telling how you okay. started.
And so, after that experience at the Pillow, and then I went to graduate school, University of Utah, and got an MFA in choreography. And one of my thesis projects for that degree was I made a dance film. And it was, of course, all filmed on different locations. And one of the locations was a supermarket. And so I think that influenced me. And so between all those events, those three events, from college to being at the Pillow with Elise, and then my thesis, and then coming back to New York right after I graduated from Utah. And while I was gone, Elise went on to start making real site-specific work herself. She did this whole event on the bridge, on the for the 100th anniversary of the Brooklyn Bridge. And I just remember talking to her during that time when I was still in Utah, just marveling at just how, you know, how amazing it was. She was tackling such big projects and things like that. And then by the time I got back to New York, she was then asking me to dance in some of her site works. And I also wrote music for some of her site works. And then she decided to stop making work and just be a full-time producer. And she started dancing in the streets. And then she invited me, because Lucinda Childs declined to do this work in the windows of Grand Central, she invited me to make this work in the windows of Grand Central Station in 1987. And that's really where my career, you know, started. It started very large. But that, you know, I was ready, I was open to the idea of doing it, absolutely. I just didn't realize what it was truly, you know, what that it was a real evolution, or, you know, I was taking a path where it was going to lead. I was just like, oh, this is an opportunity to make a work in this huge event with other incredible artists, Merce Cunningham and Lucinda and Philippe Petit, and have this opportunity to make something. It wasn't like, oh my God, I get to make a site-specific dance. It was, it was more, I get to do this and solve this creative problem, you know? And that's all it was, solving a real big problem. And I was lucky that Elise trusted me. She had seen some photographs I'd made that reminded her of the windows, because I had actually exhibited some photo booth images, composite images, because I was interested in media and photography. Mm-hmm. And that sort of said, okay, I'll go with a total unknown. So yeah. And then from there, it was successful enough that she invited me for, I think, four more times between 87 and 91. She commissioned me to make big work in, you know, like, then I went to the Wexner Center before it was made in 88. Then it was the American Museum of Natural History in New York City in 89. Then in 1990, I did a piece at Union Station. In 91, I did two pieces, one at the State of Illinois building downtown, at Helmut Jahn building, a huge building.
Was
in
there. Was that the one that you were talking that reminded you of a prison?
That's correct.
Okay, yeah.
Right. Called the Governed Body. And then earlier that, and then after that, in the fall, I went and did a version of the window piece in the windows of the 30th Street Station in Philadelphia. So that was a lot of work. That was, you know, that was, those were, that's how I truly cut my teeth and learned how to work in this way. In those 4 years.
Wow.
And yeah, it was a real education, and very exciting. And that's where I realized how powerful it can be to make work that truly is out in the world, that it can't help but interface with people and institutions and places, and it puts you in dialogue, in a way that's very exciting.
You were talking about how you're interested of breaking the insular, that start having the insular where only certain people would come and see dance, and you're interested of bringing it out for more wider audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was and Elise Bernhardt should get a lot of credit as a true pioneer. She was a producer with a real artist's eye, and she really, in a way, I think, you know, forged this. In a way, she I think she created if you want to call it a market, but she created the market for site-specific work in America. I mean, she exposed many, many people through these performances that she produced and curated and exposed, I think, lots of people to it. I mean, in those five pieces, I think I must have worked with close to 400 to 500 dancers.
Wow.
Maybe not that many. Let me think. 3,600. Yeah, well, at least 350, something like that.
Yeah.
300, 400 in different places, and then all the other artists doing stuff in public. So anyway,
I realized
things, and I learned how much fun it is. I also learned how much work it is. and while I was doing that, I was still creating work for the stage. I was still very fortunate to get produced by Dance Theater Workshop by David White. And I still am very interested in making works for the concert stage. So it wasn't like one was replacing the other. Uh-huh. It was very much that one was a wonderful supplement to doing other, to doing the work that was for the theater. Because both have, obviously, I think, very important roles.
And
I could say things on stage that, of course, I couldn't necessarily say in with sight work. It's a totally different process of making work, also.
Yeah, and I you were talking how many people you're involving in these projects. I really appreciate the part how it's important for you to work in each community with the community members and not bring any, you don't have like a company that has company members who travel around, but you always employ local people, local artists, correct?
Correct. Most of the time. Sometimes some projects I've been able to bring some artists with me, like my task force project, I was able to import dancers to a place. I had auditions in London, and then we went to Devon to do it. And I even brought two dancers from the States for that. But generally, yes, if I, when I went to Chicago, I worked with Chicago dancers. When I went to Washington, D.C., all those big pieces were all done. And even London in Germany, I mean, I will create a company in a sense.
Yeah.
And it creates an entirely other layer of engagement where you're getting to know people from that community, and then they're getting to know each other.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I really, that to me, as a community artist, that speaks to me very much, that you do sort of take the community in consideration and also use that knowledge and history that those people bring to every site.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wanted to, you talked a little bit about your inspiration, but is, you were in the site dance book, you were talking how you often start seeing it as an audience member. And to me, mm-hmm. that was really interesting because I think when I'd be working on a site specific, there's been huge, learning curves as not thinking that and not taking that as a consideration, but thinking that there are people all around and they just will go and come and go as they please. But then that has been really a drawback a couple of times. And then I was reading how you actually start, you've been starting with the thinking of the audience point of view. So can you talk about a little bit of that as an inspiration? Is that an inspiration?
Yeah, well, it's sort of a step in the creative process. In the sense that I do that to protect the work, that before I get, in a way, before I fall in love with what I want to do or say or create, I want to make sure that I've created a structure that allows that to be seen properly. So I've never thought of it this way, but it's protective. So that, like you said, if you don't think about it, sometimes it works and sometimes you have unintended results. And so I talk about this the way I, because of what happened at Grand Central, that the Mercer Cunningham Company had a stage that was built in the terminal. And because so many people showed up, only a third of the audience could see what was going on the stage. Everyone else was blocked because of the numbers of people. But then when my piece in the windows happened, all 8,000 people each night, all they had to do was look up and they had a front row seat. And so that taught me something about that it was important, even though I didn't think of it at the time. I was basically told, you're going to do this piece in the windows. I didn't think about all the other aspects of the evening, but that made me realize how people see a work is very important in terms of how they will receive it. And it's true of any theater. If you're sold a ticket and they don't tell you you have partial view, or you're sitting, you know, where you can't see the whole stage, or you've got a big something in front of you, you're not going to be happy. It's going to ruin your, in a sense, it's going to ruin your experience. So it's trying to harness a place so that you don't overpromise. So if you're making a work in an outdoor place or in a site, and you don't think about capacity, like, you know, if 500 people show up, but only 100 can see it properly, even the way you've designed it, that they can see it properly, then you've got a problem. And so that's why, yeah, I think it's important to think about that first, and then in a way, then start to play, then start to dive in. Or if you've already dove in and you say, oh, I really want to do this, then you have to be, in a way, sober about how many people can actually see it. And, you know, there are times when only 50 people can see something. And I always say, then you have to think, okay, well, if I want 300 people to see it, then maybe I should do it 6 times, you know, or maybe I should make something short so I can have, so more people can see it. It's all a matter of what are your priorities, and what is the context of you showing this work? Are you inviting people to see it, or is it just something that's going to happen spontaneously?
Just an accidental audience.
Yeah, an accidental audience.
Yeah.
So that too comes into play. I do very little accidental audience works, or I do one where there's a combination of them, and you still have to think, you know, so that's why I think about this.
Yeah, it was really refreshing to read about that and be like, oh yes, this is also about providing the art experience to people who will come, and you have to take that into very much into consideration. So it was really nice for me to read about it and start thinking about it in that way.
Yeah.
Then also you were talking about how you take inspiration from the history or the architect of the space. Like in Germany, you went to the coal mine, right?
It was a coke factory. It was a factory.
Okay.
Yeah, it was no longer being used, but it was a factory that processed coal into a condensed form called coke.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so how much do you read about the history of the site? Or does it vary?
Yeah, I mean, really quickly, I say this a lot because it's something that I then sort of taught in that class, which is the four entryways to make work. And it is architecture, design, it's history, then it's current use, current history, and then there's the community. And it really depends on the piece and how much, you know, I'm not a historian, although it was the first thing I thought I would be when I was in high school. So it's nice that I get to do work that makes me research history. But it depends on the work. Sometimes I will spend a lot of time reading and researching. I did that when I did this piece at the Natural History Museum in London. other times I, you know, it's gotten easier with the internet for me, you know, for everyone to do research. I don't have to, you know, go get books out of the library and things like that. But it really depends on what is really exciting me about a work. So if I am going to use historical knowledge to be part of it, then yeah, then I want to sort of cover my bases and do research. It also depends how much time I have.
Yeah.
If I'm working purely visually with the design of a site, then I still do historical research just to make sure I'm not losing out on something important. But I may not spend quite as much time as long as I cover the basic facts. Uh-huh. When I did Grand Central in 87, that first piece, I really didn't, it's funny, I didn't really research the history of the train station or those windows because the current use of the train station hit me harder, which was there were a lot of homeless people in New York City. There still are, a lot of them were living in Grand Central. And that fact, the current use of the station, was really affected me, and the design of the windows, the incredible, you know, grandeur of these windows and the effect that they had on me. So that's in a sense what inspired that work. The fact that it was in a train station where people go. It's a commuter, you know, Grand Central Terminal is a commuter train station. So it's a place where people go to go home. And it was a place that people were making their home. So that was a more trenchant fact that inspired my work. And that's why the score has references to home in it. And began in a way to inform the kind of choreography I would do, on top of the fact of just dealing with the windows in a visual manner.
Yeah.
So there was two things going on. But other works I look at very historically, like the Natural History Museum piece. I did delve into Darwin, because he was an inspiration as to why the building was built. I spent in Germany. I was the producers there very graciously took me on a tour of museums that around that area in Germany that showed the history of coal mining, of excavation, and the whole history of the factories. So that definitely informed that work. So it really depends. Some pieces will, in a way, demand a lot of research, and some of them will simply demand just research on site.
Yeah. I really loved reading about the how you accidentally, or you didn't realize quite what a impact the German work had before.
Yeah.
Even though you had done your research, still there was this accidental huge impact that it had on people.
It did. I mean, but it also had
and
a very
because
positive.
It wasn't meant to be political, right?
No.
Yeah.
It wasn't, but I think there was a everyone brings their own stories and their own history to a piece. So, in that particular work, there were people who had worked in that factory. Who were still living in Essen. The factory had been decommissioned like 25 years earlier. It was right, but there are still people who work there, and they came and saw it, and they saw it as a beautiful, let's say, homage to their labor. But then other people who took it and likened it to forced labor camps during the Nazi era. I did make a work that was about the human cost of labor around mining and around, you know, excavation. And so there was that, and in that in itself is sort of political, but I wasn't tagging it to a specific historical event. I was more tagging it as a as an event that's happened through history. You know, like you talk, you know, you look at coal miners all around the world are, you know, die for their they die for their those jobs because, you know, they have they'll get black lung or a coal mine will implode. It's not a it's not a industry without human cost. And so there was that aspect that there was a whole section in that work that was about the human cost, the struggle. So I'm not surprised. I was surprised that people honed in on, let's say, a particular historical event, which then had a big impact on me because, you know, as a Jew, I, you know, I was actually not wanting to get involved in the history of German politics, believe it or not. I was really focusing on the site and what the site was saying to me. So that's why it was a bit of a shock. But, you know, it wasn't perhaps I gave the wrong impression. People saw the work and engaged with it because it was it's a huge space. It was a monumental work in terms of scale. And also because it was taking place in so many different parts of this factory. And people were discovering the insides of the factory as the piece went on. So there was that going on also. It wasn't just this polemical work, you know.
So do you think that's one of the vulnerabilities of doing site-specific work is because you might go into site that somebody has a relation, like a personal relationship that they can read more into through their own experience than when you are in a box? Where a lot of people might have never actually been as a performer. They have always had the experience of just being the audience members. But then you're taking this risk or you're making yourself more vulnerable for these very, maybe even painful, like, interpretations of your work.
I yes, absolutely. I mean, that's true also of a work for the stage. If you make a work or a movie about a topic that perhaps perhaps you have not done all your research, or there are ways in which people are being depicted that is that some people think is inaccurate. And that's why I do say that it's important to do historical research, no matter what your inspiration is, ultimately, with the work. You know, I always give the, you know, give the simple example of if you're doing a work out in the woods or out in a field, and you think, well, there's no history here, and you start working, and then you do your piece and invite people to come, and someone taps you on the shoulder and says, do you realize that this is an ancient burial ground? And, you know, you know, you go, what? So anyway, I mean, so that's why history is important. But it's also, look, you can't never know everything. There's just not enough, you know, hours in a day for someone to be completely exhaustive.
Yeah, true.
You know.
True. So you've been in this field for a long time. What, if any, changes you perceive is needed for better representation of the field? Do you think we are ready to talk about that? Has it been long enough? Is there enough history?
When you say field, what field are you talking about?
Site-specific dance.
Oh, site-specific dance. Mm-hmm. Okay, your question again is what do I feel?
You perceive is that there's needed change needed for a better representation.
Well, I don't know. I think, you know, because I don't think of site-specific dance as being separate from, let's say, any other community. I think I consider site-specific dance to be part of the dance community. It's just a different practice within it. It's a different way of expressing one's choreographic vision, but it's not, I don't see it as a separate Well, I don't know. I don't see it as a separate community, but it's a subset of a larger community. So that's number one. Well, I mean, in terms of acceptance, what has been positive is that people, I think, in the past used to perceive it as a separate entity. So I think that's changing. I think people are looking at it more and more as part of, let's say, whatever you consider the canon of work. At least I believe it is part of the canon, even though it takes on a different form. I mean, you look at Merce Cunningham, and I consider him a pioneer of forging and opening people's minds up to many things in dance, but also in terms of sight work. Even though he was not inspired by sights to make his work, he sighted his work, he placed his work in different locations throughout his career in ways that forced people to encounter dance in public places. And that work is considered part of his canon. He's considered part of the canon, the history of dance, of contemporary dance. So I think in all the years I've been involved, I think that has evolved in a positive way, meaning it's not seen so much as outsider art, let's say.
Okay, I see.
Seen
less separate. It's part of just the dance field.
I absolutely think so. And I think, frankly, also the economy, the fact that, unfortunately, contemporary dance has not grown economically in America, especially, meaning, you know, the market isn't booming. Let's say, sales of art are breaking records. I would say that sales of choreography per se, in the performing arts world, are not breaking record. creating a sustainable career for artists, unfortunately,
mm-hmm.
but has forced artists who don't have access to theater space consider taking their work to other alternative spaces, which then starts to getting them thinking about what is the nature of sight work. Do they, you know, and I think this idea of making art where you find it is one that has helped sight work.
But I also think you are taking it into another level. You are offering a course to really look into how to work site-specific dance, right?
One of the reasons why I did that course and the way I do teach sight work when I'm teaching it is that I teach it as an art form. I don't teach it as, oh, here's a way for you to, like, you know, save money.
Yes.
And not have to rent a theater. I think the economy of that has made some artists who really want to keep making work consider things outside of the theater. But I believe very strongly that if you do that, you need to really be considerate of your new context and take the process seriously, not just use the world as a place to put your potted plants.
Yeah.
You know, without thought. You know, without any
absolutely.
Thought.
And I meant it more as a part, as an art form, because I'm thinking like the future of physically integrated dance in the United States. Feel like the next step is that there is an academia part of it, that there is a place for a person with a disability to go and get a dance degree, being integrated into a, not a separate program, but being integrated into the existing programs. And I think what I was saying, you offering this as a course to educate is to people who want to make it, to learn to make it as an art form, not to make it so that you can just make your work out because you can't afford a studio.
Right. And I guess what you're saying too is that by offering this course, it or in other people offering courses in site work, that it does both integrate the practice also into the community in a more formal way.
And it educates people.
Right, and also educates people as to what it's all about. Yes, yeah. And that's yes, I agree. And I, my interest in doing that class though was not academic so much as truly as a tool, and as, I mean, I'm more interested in helping people with solving problems. I'm not as interested, although it does interest me, I'm not as interested as an artist in the theory around the work. I'm more interested in the how-to and the method and inspiring more and more people to make the work.
Mm-hmm.
The theories around it and all that, I find always endlessly fascinating. It's just not something that I personally want to spend time developing. There are better and smarter people in the world to do that. But I'm really interested in activating other artists and activating people into making work, into getting inspired, into not being afraid, you know, like trying to demystify the process and say, you know, yeah, okay, I made all this big work with lots of people and big places, and it could look like it's complicated, or gee, how does it do it? But break that down to show that it's actually doable. Not that everyone should be making big work, but even work with lots of people, or you know, that it's actually possible. Now it's less possible in reality now because of the economy. You know, a lot of the big work I made was in the late 80s and during the 90s, and you know, presenters and producers don't have those kinds of budgets anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not around. Universities can take on larger scale projects now because of the fact that you're not having to pay everyone involved. It's being done in the context of education, and so some costs are inherently already taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
So I have been able in the last 5 years to do large work, but ironically, most of the large work has been connected to universities, and it's been fine. I mean, it's a different way of making the work, but my aim has always been to maintain as high standards, you know,
yeah,
with these institutions as possible, and I'm happy to say that I feel fine about it. I'm working on a big project right now that takes place in 2018 with two colleges in Minnesota, where I'm going to Carleton College and St. Olaf, and they both share a small town in Minnesota called Northfield, Minnesota, and I'm basically come up with a plan to take over the whole town, so to speak, create works all through the city. And I could never do that on my own without the support of these two institutions, because of the fact that they have resources. So that's, in a way, that's what's changed also.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to continue to be this way, because our government and municipalities and foundations are not able to fund things quite the same way. And it's not just for site work; it's for all work.
That's true.
And I hope it will change.
I hope so too. I hope so too. I hope somebody's listening to this and hearing what you're saying. I want to go back a little bit of like music on site specific work, because I feel like that's definitely its own challenges, because site specific, or the places have so much audio on themselves often, you know, like Grand Central Station has a lot of sounds. So how do you go about putting an audio or music to your work?
Well, the first question is do you need audio?
That's I experienced when I was doing my fellowship at Keshet in January. We did 5 site-specific. It was just me and my colleague, 2 of us, and we never had any audio except what the location provided to us.
Yeah,
but
well,
then we brought that work into a black box to make a performance in a black box, and then it was very, very quiet. But it was really hard to put audio onto something that was so rich in its location in audio, but was so empty in a silent space. So,
you could have recorded.
Oh, we did some recording. Yeah, we did. We brought some sounds, but it wasn't enough.
What were your sites?
We so were at Bosque, which is a cottonwood forest. Then we were at Explora, which is children's museum. Then we were in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Okay, and you got your MFA where? At the University of New Mexico?
No, I actually don't have an MFA. This was a fellowship I received. It was the Keshet for Keshet Fellowship for Contemporary Dance for 2017.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then we danced in a train. We went from Albuquerque to Santa Fe and Santa Fe to Albuquerque. We danced in the train. And then we went to the Hot Air Balloon Museum, of course, because we were in Albuquerque. So we did record sounds. And we did take sounds from the nature and leaves and dirt and, you know, create. But it's still, while bringing some of the movement material into a studio, going from that way was easier, but the audio, I found it super difficult and challenging. So.
Well, yeah, you know, it depends on the, you know, if you're talking about how to make sound, you know, for a site, some sites are so large that, and Grand Central, you see, the thing about Grand Central was that Elise just decided, you know, that there was going to be sound, partly because Merce Cunningham was performing with his company doing an event, and they always had sound. So they rigged that whole terminal with huge speakers. And actually, the only way I could organize, see, music and sound can be used in order to actually conduct the performers in a way that if you want them to be coordinated. So I actually wanted to create very specific designs with the bodies. And so you had 9 dancers on 4 levels and they couldn't see the other 27. Okay. So they all shared sound. So they all were counting a lot. So a score can help you do that. But sometimes, like I did a piece last year, or the year before last, in San Diego for this project called Trolley Dances, and I was working in a fountain, a fountain that was actually it was a fountain that people would swim in. It was like a fountain that invited people to get wet, and it had these chutes of water coming down, and it made a lot of noise. Made a lot of sound. And at first I was thinking, oh, gee, maybe I'll have like a percussion ensemble or some kind of score to go with the water. But the more I spent time with the water, the more I realized, no, everything I'm going to do is going to compete with this beautiful sound of the water. Just let that be the sound. So I think that's a first big decision is because if you're going to introduce sound into a site, that's a very that can pull people out of the site. Like if you and that's why I like to work with original scores, because I want the sound to support my vision of what I'm doing in the site and to be part of that vision. I don't think I would, you know, I'm not one to want to like bring in pop music or other music to it unless there's a very specific reference I'm making. I mean, even the score for Grand Central back in 1987, I accessed Gregorian chants. And the reason was because I wanted to give reference the sense of spirituality I felt the windows conveyed as like windows in a church, in a cathedral, and the fact that they were like stained glass windows, even though they weren't. So it really depends. But anyway, that whole process is very delicate. And working with composers in the creation of this work is also, you know, very delicate and not easy. Especially because they're working, like you are, in a very compressed amount of time. If they're making something at the same time that you are. But I would say not to ever be afraid of just going with ambient sound. I believe, like Merce Cunningham, that dance should be free of the shackles of any music narrative, if it wishes to be.
I love it.
So I always think, I always tell my students, no sound is better than bad sound, because it's very powerful.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah. True. I was very surprised how challenging that process was with the audio. I never felt it while doing the site specific, but then bringing it into the black box was.
Well, that's because you're actually crossing a taking one thing from one context and putting it into another, and then you realize, as you have, that it's a completely different way of looking at it. And so, and some things can cross over, but other things can't. And so,
true.
I wouldn't be hard on yourself that it was difficult, because you actually were creating a very challenging problem for yourself to solve.
It was super fun though, and it turned out well, but it was surprised that I wasn't prepared for it, because I didn't realize how much there was audio when dancing in site-specific public. You listen your partner, you listen the sounds, they're constantly like fed some. I had a beautiful, rich music in my head, and then coming into a black box, it was like crickets.
Yeah. Like crickets.
So, talking about your future projects, you're doing something this summer with Axis as well.
Yes. Yes, I am. I'm very excited about it. It's a work that will take place in the Yerba Buena Gardens. Right in downtown San Francisco, next to the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. And it's a work that will involve the company, which is about seven people at this time. And we have hired 14 other area dancers to augment the company. So there'll be about 20 performers in this work, and it will be a promenade work, meaning that the audience will, walk from place to place as they follow the work, and it is taking place in very specific locations inside the park that will reference actually occupancy and space and how it affects us as humans, and lack of space and migration and displacement, all those things, which is something that references both the history of that park, the Yerba Buena Center, and the park were created by tearing down a lot of apartment buildings. Some of them housing folks who are not wealthy. There were a lot of single occupancy hotels. So there's a lot of controversy in the creation of the Yerba Buena Gardens and the Arts Center, and I guess also Moscone, the Moscone Center, which is their convention center. All that was under some controversy, but now that controversy is past, and a new one is what's happening in all these large cities in terms of people being artists and young folks with low income being priced out of neighborhoods. And it's happening in New York City. It's happening in San Francisco, of course. It's happening in a lot of towns.
It's happening in Austin.
It is, okay. So in a way, the work is referencing both the design of the park, but also in relationship to how bodies are affected. And so I had this idea that instead of creating these small little works that perhaps, you know, take place in these different locations, I would actually go the opposite and have these small locations inhabited by lots of people and see what that would mean and what are the tensions around that. And so that's where I'm starting from, of the physical tension of too many people in a place and different able-bodied people also, people who are going to navigate the space in different ways. So it's really looking at all those aspects of displacement, displacement of too many people, displacement of people who aren't given equal access, all those things. But at the same time, making a work that hopefully is visually interesting. Mm-hmm. So
I'm excited for that. I hope I can come and see.
Yeah, I'm excited too. My first rehearsal starts at the end of this month, in 3 weeks. Yeah. So it's my first project with Access and my first project working with differently abled performers. And it's been it's already just been such a great education for me and really changed and opened my mind about just what you were talking about earlier, about truly integrating, widening the definition of just everything. And that's what Access is all about. That's what's really great. You know, they really are trying to change the definition of, you know, of dance and performance.
I think they have done it already a little bit.
Absolutely have, and they keep doing it.
Yeah, definitely. Judy is such a powerhouse. There's nothing that can stop that woman.
Absolutely. Well, he and I have been talking for like 13 years about this. And then in the last, you know, and then intensely for the last 3 or 4 years. So she's been really wonderfully tenacious and they've worked really hard to make this happen.
Awesome. I cannot wait. So is there something that you still dream about? Is there a location? Is there like the big Stephen Koplovich location?
Well, there are locations that I wanted to work in that I never that eluded my grasp. But I guess one needs, you know, this happens a lot too. I mean, you see a place and you go, oh gosh, it'd be great to do something there, and it wouldn't, you know, it doesn't happen. You have to get over it and focus on what you are doing. And you know, I always say that to my students who want to do something. You know, when I taught site work, even on campus at CalArts, they would fixate on one site and then we would realize that it wasn't possible because of we couldn't get permission or it just wasn't doable because it was too far away. And I'd say, well, don't worry. When you do settle on the site you have, you will refall in love with what you have, and that's what happens. I mean, but in London, I've always wanted to do a work in the original location of the British Library, which was the Round Reading Room, which is located inside the British Museum. So that wasn't going to happen in 95 when I first saw it because they were moving it to a new location, which they did. And then I got invited to make a work in the new library in London, very different than the Round Reading Room. But then several years later, the Dance Umbrella Festival and the British Museum invited me to make a work in the museum. And even then I wasn't going to be able to work in the Round Reading Room because it was being repurposed and construction or whatever, but I was going to make a work in the museum itself. But that went away because of the crash of 2008, 2009, and that whole project disappeared. So, and I spent 2 years working on it, developing a whole artistic plan around what I would do. And I have this book, this little booklet, you know, on my, you know, and here in my office. And it's just this thing that never happened. So I sometimes think about, you know, the what if around that. But, you know, the truth is that, no, I mean, there are projects I've done, like my Grand Step project, which I naively thought I could take and do around the world and grand staircases around the world. But of course that didn't happen. And I am still waiting for someone to help me bring that project to another set of stairs anywhere outside of New York. So I do have that thought. Even going back to New York would be amazing, because there are like 5 or 6 other grand staircases in New York alone that I'd love to work on. But no, I mean, I think I'm more focusing now on making work that can travel, that is smaller. And if there are sites that come up that I am interested in, or that other people are interested in having me engage in, that always excites me. Always excites me to discover something new. Like the whole project in Northfield came about only because Carlton and St. Olaf invited me to come and propose a project that would bring those two schools together. I'm the one who was inspired by seeing Northfield, which is the town they share. They're both on either side of the town. And then I proposed doing a project that used Northfield as the backdrop, as the script, and they both agreed. And so that was exciting to discover that, and to venture into a project that, in a way, is going to be, you know, ironically, maybe one of my largest projects to date, just because of the scale of working in so many places in a town. And the same thing with, I'm doing another project this summer. It happens a month after the one in San Francisco with Access at the Bates Dance Festival. And there, Laura Farr invited me to come up and look at the town of Lewiston and Auburn. And she and I spent time visiting different sites around town quite extensively, with the idea that there would be something that would take place not on the campus of Bates College, but in the city of Lewiston and Auburn. And now we're working towards this huge project with media and dance and performance in one of the old mills, which they have many of. They're all being reconfigured into different spaces for retail and offices. And so that's happening this summer also. And so that's opened up a whole lot of research about the history of the city, of those two cities, and of the mills and all that. I don't know.
It's like you make your sites your dream sites, whatever they are. They become your dream sites.
In a sense, they do, because you what's exciting is you start discovering things that you just don't know anything about. And that it's sort of the process. It would be wonderful to be invited to do, okay, you know, I grew up in Paris, France. My father was in the government, and I grew up in Paris, and I've never done any work in Paris. So it would be a dream for me to work in France, let's say. Mm-hmm. I speak French. It was like my first language, and you know, the French culture is part of me. So that would be a real dream, let's say. Awesome. It was a real dream to work in Italy. I have twice now in Spoleto, through the auspices of the La Mama Theater, their Umbria program. I'm half Italian, and I spent a lot of time in Italy as a child. So it was wonderful to do that. I've spent time in Korea. And I love Seoul, Korea, and it would be wonderful to go back there and do and make work there. I guess my dream is just to keep having the work take me to places that I don't know. And so, that would,
you know, I'm from Finland originally, and so we need to come up with the Finnish location for you.
Okay, and it'd be something for both of us to work on then.
Yeah, definitely.
I've always wanted to go to Finland. Do you go back often?
We try. We've been going for every summer. As soon as the kids get off for school, we'll take off and spend the summers there.
Oh, that's great. Well, they have a very interesting dance community in Finland. I've gotten to know that.
We have a very strong sense of community, I think, compared to, like, our contact improvisation community is big and strong and skilled and, contemporary dance community as well.
I see. And what brought you to the United States?
Oh, I would love to say something really amazing, but it's not. It's love. It's my husband.
Well, that's a great reason.
It's like the oldest traditional story you have ever heard. So
okay, but it's it's what makes the world go around.
That's true. That is true.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for talking with me, Stephen. It was wonderful to actually get to see you and know you a little bit more. Like I said before, you're definitely one of my role models and heroes in the field. So thank you for inspiring and educating.
Oh, well, thank you. It's a pleasure, and I hope our paths can cross for real in the future. If you need an excuse, I guess, to come up to San Francisco in July. It's July 1st and 2nd are the performance dates.
If you know somebody who would be a really good guest at my Dance Gas episodes, you can email me at silva@bodyshift.org, which is S-I-L-V-A at bodyshift, bodyshift.org. Email me your suggestions for a guest in my upcoming episodes. Thanks.